Thank you for the invitation to be here again. Ulm was the last time I was within a German-speaking group. My German is not so good, but I was happy to join this meeting because I think it's great also for parents to meet each other and to have a chance to walk around, speak with different parents, see the children that, if there are any questions, some of you have sent me emails with questions, so it's nice to see you again. I will be speaking on mental health and well-being in Phelan-McDermid syndrome, with a specific focus on psychiatric problems within the syndrome. This has also been described in the guideline Michael just mentioned, but I'll take you through the information. Oops, now I should use this, right? This I'm by the Dutch Psychiatric Association, I'm obligated to show you that I have no financial conflicts. And I would want to congratulate you on your 10th year anniversary. I know there was a party last night. I think it ran a little late, but after a 10-hour train right, my colleague Margreet Walinga and I decided we couldn't stay for your party, but I hope it was fun. Congratulations. So in a short overview, Phelan-McDermid syndrome is a rare genetic syndrome. Of course, we have the rarity of rarities, which is Katie right here in your conference. All of these things you know, but it's often necessary to explain to your physician or your therapist, again, these are the issues that we are dealing with in our child, of which we know the marked speech impairment or the lack of speech is a difficult one in communicating with your child. There are very variable clinical presentations which always make it difficult to discuss when there's an issue and the doctor doesn't exactly know if the issue is fits with the syndrome, yes or no. It's important to have this overview. I really wanted to show you this, so I was a bit nervous if Katie was going to show this, but she told me she wasn't. So if we understand why is it important to have SHANK3 protein. So Katie just explained to us all these different issues are necessary to build networks. If there is a protein missing, the connections between transferring information from one side to the other side of the synapse can be problematic. So SHANK3 is an important protein to establish these connections. And we need these connections for information to travel to the part of the body where the information needs to be used in motor skills or in speech or in whatever adaptive functioning is necessary. So before we published the guideline, there was a large parental survey, global, in all of 35 countries where parents and caregivers indicated their worries about their children or loved ones. It wasn't just children, were adults also. And the most frequently experienced problems were speech and the worry about how to communicate with your loved one, intellectual disability, and behavioral problems. So as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I'm of course specifically interested in behavioral issues and how to address these. But we also noted that the prevalence of epilepsy and seizures, lymphedema, increased with age. This is also in the guideline. You have the guideline so you can find it. So if we think about the big questions for today, how often is there a neuropsychiatric illness in Phelan-McDermid syndrome? What does it look like and what triggers it? And we specifically want to know what triggers it so we can maybe think about an intervention to prevent this trigger. And if it's there, how can we treat it? The difficulty with this syndrome is that many of the symptoms that we see and consider psychiatric may be part of the baseline of the syndrome. So there's sleep problems, there can be behavioral problems in sense of motor restlessness, there can be aggression, repetitive speech, echolalia. If there is speech, it might be limited and repetitive. Shouting, eating, pica is eating substances that are not food, could be stones, could be whatever, and headbanging or other forms of self-injury. And we know that any behavioral problem should always be considered within the context of life. And this might be family and environment. There might have been changes in the family. There might have been loss. There might have been a move to a different residence. So these changes also need to be considered when there are changes in behavior. And of course, the individual with Van Allen-McDermid syndrome, we need to know what level that person has to understand issues in his life and what the social and emotional development might be. So we know neuropsychiatric problems in Van Allen-McDermid syndrome are common. This means they occur often. And we know those that occur most often are mood disturbances, loss of skills after onset of psychiatric disturbance, and catatonia. So I'll say something about loss of skills, but I know Margreet is going to be talking about that also. So this will be in her talk. Oh, a little? Oh, not at all. Okay, all right. Okay, I'll talk about it then. So we know that neuropsychiatric problems often start in adolescence. And there is some discussion about, does this have to do with hormonal changes? Are there changes in demands? If your child is taller, people expect different behavior than if your child is a baby. If your child has a certain age, we have different expectations of what they can do. And we know in 53% of this is in the literature, there's an indication of catatonia. And I'll be speaking on that a little later. So for parents, Katie has also said, if you did not have a karyotype, and you should find out, you should ask your doctor if it's a ring chromosome. So parents have an important role in vigilance, paying attention to differences, changes. And this is why we emphasize in the guideline also to establish a picture of a baseline. What does your child like? And we know this can change over time, so you need to note changes over time. So you might love this video at a certain time and not love it anymore at a further stage in his life. And we know that the way to impress your doctor when you want to discuss that there has been a change is to show film. So you do on your everybody has, I think it's a handy in German, with your handy. You can make little films and keep those. So when there is an issue, you can show your doctor, well, he was doing this before, and he now can no longer do this, or he's doing this differently. And we must remember that sometimes psychiatric symptoms can be part of the baseline. This means that there might be some symptoms that can be considered psychiatric, but might be something that belongs with the syndrome. So if we look at language and absent speech, which is one of the common characteristics of the syndrome, We note that both expressive and receptive communicative abilities are affected. So this means speech is a problem, and possibly also understanding when you're spoken to. So I noticed yesterday several parents signing, so the use of signs and understanding signs, that's also a way that you can communicate with your child without words. So impairments in expressive language are likely to contribute to the communication problems, how to understand what's happening with your child, and these may also lead to challenging behavior. And challenging behavior can mean anything from self-injury, shouting, running, jumping, so it can be any of those problems. Oops, I should use this. Intellectual disability ranges from moderate to profound. So that means if there is profound intellectual disability, some of the behaviors might be even more difficult to understand. What's happening? Why is my child chewing on his t-shirt? Why is my child ripping up his t-shirt? So all of these things are, you need to be like a detective to try to determine what was the issue that led to the behavior and how to resolve so that the behavior does not reoccur. And there are many difficulties with attaining adaptive and daily living skills. And daily living skills are dressing yourself, choosing your socks, deciding on your dinner, brushing your teeth. So many of the things that you, that we feel children should learn when they're young so that they can use that those skills later. And one of the worrying symptoms with the syndrome is there might be decreased pain perception. So there might be significant pain before the person with Phelan-McDermid syndrome might give an indication of the pain. So this is important to understand and realize as parents so that you can be very alert if there might be something going on, a burn, severe teeth problems, gastric reflux, it might be any of those issues that can be very painful. So discussing PMS, and we know PMS is one of the syndromes that can have an autism phenotype, but it's very difficult to diagnose autism in Phelan-McDermid syndrome because we know that some of the symptoms might also be explained by lack of adaptive functioning or intellectual disability. So as a rule of thumb, we would say frequency and intensity of autism symptoms are more clear, more frequent, more intense than we would expect given the person's developmental level. So if you're very small, I mean, if your age is very as a child and your development is maybe a 1 or 2 year old, flapping your hands is considered a normal part of development. So if the individual is 15 and has PMS and also flaps his hands, now we're not sure whether this is fitting with a developmental level of a 2 year old, which the person might have, or whether this is beyond what we would expect for the intellectual disability that fits with the PMS. Also, the presentation might be different, but we know that many of the repetitive behaviors are similar to what we can see in autism. Usually, many of the motor disturbances also can be similar. So sensory dysfunction occurs in several domains for patients with PMS, and the reduced pain perception, so not feeling the pain immediately, but having a build-up of that can be distressing. There's problems with regulating heat. I think you're going to say more about that. So this will, Margreet will discuss more of this. We know aggressive behavior may be linked to sensory dysfunction. experiencing pain or experience strange sensations on your skin, from your clothing, something like that can lead to aggressive behaviors that might not be directed to somebody else, but might be directed to the person himself. And we know that some dysregulation of mood or affective disorder could be underlying these problems. So, I'll just wait one. So if we think about regression, there's been several mentions of regression. We know that it's defined as a prolonged loss, usually more than 3 months, of skills previously acquired. So these might be skills like putting on your own t-shirt or putting on your socks and no longer being able to do that for a longer period than just one or two times. But we also know that this starts around adolescence. So this is within the frame of there are changes during adolescence which we do not completely understand but might be relevant and need to be noted by parents. And even those who have attained speech might have issues with their speech. They might start having more repetitive expressions. And we know that some of these regressive episodes have been reported to co-occur with the emergence of mood disorders, might be bipolar or mood cycling symptoms. So having a happy mood, going from a happy mood to a bad mood, from a bad mood to a happy mood. These are cycling symptoms. But we know that this has a major impact, regression has a major impact on daily life. So we also see in the literature that behavior suggestive of hyperactivity and attention deficit are commonly reported. And this is the same difficulty as diagnosing autism in a person who is intellectually disabled. How to disentangle what is with the intellectual disability, what fits with the intellectual disability, and what fits with what might be autism or what might be attention deficit disorder. This is why changes in behavior should be monitored over time with a mind to what is typical for your child, so what you're used to in your child and how is that different from what he did before, and within a routine. So if the routine is certain hour and then you wake up, you have your breakfast, you go out, you have your activities, these are the things your child enjoys, you know this. This would be the routine of your child. And differences in that routine could have an impact, but also differences in behavior could have an impact on the routine. So if your child is having self-injurious behavior, you might be less likely to go out with this child. So this would have an impact on his daily activities. So if you think about restless behavior, motor disturbances, we should always think about catatonia. And it's characterized by behavioral, affective, and motor disturbances. So we know there's actually three types of catatonia. Hyper motoric, hypo, so less motor movement, and there is a malignant form, which usually has to do with the use of certain medications and can have a major impact can be considered a life-threatening complication. So needs to be identified and needs to be treated. And we know that sometimes catatonic states can occur after stressful life events. Such as moving to a different residence or maybe loss of trusted treatment staff or having a physical illness like an infection. These can be considered triggers for catatonia, for the emergence of catatonia. So in the different types of catatonia, as described here on the side, is excited, akinetic, so all different names for the same things. Akinetic means you move less. Excited means you move a lot. You might be jumping. You might be restless. You might be waving your arms. And these can also occur periodically. So you might have a picture of moving less and then moving more, moving less, moving more. And this could be repeated over time, which makes it very hard for doctors to recognize. Because we usually assume, it's of course one of the problems doctors have, when we find something, we go, well, this is it. So this doesn't fit, so we can't fit it in. So as parents, you need to also think about if there are differences and changes over time. Are these reoccurring? Does it actually look the same as my child had last month? Does it look different? If it looks different, how does it look different? Maybe, you know, make a little video so that you can see what's happening. Then movement is always a difficult thing to discuss with doctors, especially when there's intellectual disability involved. I know Margreet will speak on this also. Many times, doctors from different disciplines than the discipline Margreet has, which is a physician for intellectual disability, is a specific discipline in the Netherlands. Doctors will assume it can be explained by the intellectual disability. So if you express your worries, doctors might say, well, yeah, because maybe he didn't sleep well, maybe his activity schedule is too busy, maybe it's not busy enough. So there's these many different arguments that you might have to make. So this is why having these little baseline videos is a smart thing to do. So if you look at hypokinetic or akinetic, that means you're very slowed, you're almost not moving, or you have a rigid way of standing or sitting, and you might have very different ways of, for example, walking, hunched over as if you're in pain, even if there is no pain. And the hyperkinetic form often looks like, well, at least to psychiatrists, looks like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. This may lead to the prescribing of medications to address hyperkinetic movements while there might be something else going on. But we also sometimes see tremors. Tremors are repetitive movements, for example, of hands or feet, and agitation. So going a little more into the excited or hyperkinetic catatonia, many doctors will never have heard of it or even have seen it. And it can also be very hard to distinguish it from severe mania. So this is a psychiatric thing where the behavior increases and there's loud screaming, shouting, yelping, and jumping. It can be any over moving, fitting with a psychiatric issue as mania. It also, complicates the issue is that it often starts when there is a mood disturbance or there is a certain trigger that has to do with mood cycling. We see restlessness, pacing, sometimes oppositional behavior, so your child is less willing to do what you are asking him to do or what you are sending him to do. There's unclear speech, if there is speech. Trouble managing saliva. So there's drooling, difficulty holding food in the mouth, so the food may fall out, even bringing it to the mouth, it may fall out, difficulty chewing, or even refusing food. There can be physical and behavioral rigidity, so oppositional rigidity might mean I want you to sit and the child would just keep standing and not sit, as in opposition to your wishes. Sometimes new repeating of words, so echolalia, could be anything, your words, their own words. frequent brief and unproductive trips to a bathroom. So there might be the person might have difficulty urinating specifically. There might be a tremor. And a major telltale sign is the flushing of skin, red blotches on the chest, face, and neck. Red, I'm obviously red because I'm nervous presenting here, but you might notice that there is blotches, and these can also include purplish mottling of the hands. So this is a sign that you should have to investigate whether there is catatonia going on. And unfortunately, this presentation can also include psychotic symptoms, which are very difficult to identify because it might be any type of screaming about hearing something or just screaming. So this is a very difficult clinical presentation to identify. So if it's identified, then obviously it's very important to treat. And we know that treating an underlying disorder that has triggered the catatonia is important first. You need to think about, is there urinary tract infection? Is there something going on in, is there caries? Is there constipation? What's going on? Think about the physical issues that might lead to a catatonic state. And then prevent complications, because if somebody is jumping, so there's one in the, Michael already said, the American Echo Group, there was one clinical presentation of a young man jumping so much that he had lost 20 kilos in a week. So this is serious. So thinking about how to prevent those complications also means you need to note that there is a change, then you need to take action. Usually, when there have been behavioral manifestations before the catatonic state, it is unfortunate, but it happens a lot, antipsychotics have been prescribed. And we know antipsychotics in this syndrome may be a trigger for a catatonia state, and it might be either the stuporous, not moving catatonia, but it can also be the excited catatonia. And we know benzodiazepines is the first line of treatment, usually in much higher doses than doctors are used to. So there's in the guideline, this is explained also, it's also in the American guideline. Obviously, during the use of lorazepam, you should have vital signs monitored. So this is about blood pressure, breathing, and dosing the medication three times daily spreads it out over the day and improves the activity level that the person can attain regardless of having the catatonia. It usually has a obvious effect on the improvement, and it should be continued for a longer period of time than general physicians are used to. So this is I'll not go. So the second line of treatment is electroconvulsive therapy. So this is a therapy where we induce an epileptic convulsion as a reset of the electric activity of the brain. Sometimes one or two or three times is not enough, and there should be a maintenance ECT where during a longer period of time, there's two or three times a week, there is a session to have this electric reset of the brain. So this means, in summary, that a comprehensive diagnostic formulation is needed. And the difficulty with this is that there are changes over time. Your loved one grows older, and there might be different issues in different periods of their life. So this is actually not a very helpful recommendation. It was as a recommendation in the guideline, because it should have also said ongoing monitoring might lead to a new diagnostic formulation. So over time, the diagnostic formulation also needs to be updated. And this also means that sometimes physical assessments are necessary periodically, so you know that the teeth are okay, that the skin is okay, that if there's something going on, this should be addressed before behavioral psychiatric presentations occur. And again, here it's important for parents to note differences and changes. And of course, we know that mental health and developmental problems and behavioral problems do not only impact the individual. They have a profound effect on family, on parents, siblings, on family life. And we know from the parental survey, the global survey, that parental stress is stress especially concerning the future. What will happen? Who will take care? Who will understand my loved one with Phelan-McDermid syndrome when I'm no longer able to do that? So this is a continuous stress over time. And it's important as parents to understand that there might be a discrepancy between developmental level and chronological age. So your loved one might be 25, but at a developmental level of a 2-year-old. So this can sometimes place the behaviors within a different light. So in my last night slide, I wanted to emphasize that it's important to have a baseline in different life stages. And it's important for parents to note changes. And also to remember that they are considered psychiatric symptoms, that these symptoms may be part of the baseline of the syndrome. That a comprehensive diagnostic formulation is necessary and might need updating over time. And regarding parental stress and family functioning, to emphasize, ask for help. Now, there might be in your network people that will be able to help you and willing to help you. And it's important to understand that if your own well-being is at stake, it will be harder to organize care for your loved one with Phelan-McDermid syndrome. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Sehr aufschlussreicher Vortrag, und ich denke, sie hat es rübergebracht, dass es wahrscheinlich eines der komplexesten Themen ist, wenn es ums Phelan-McDermid Syndrom geht. Inge, can I just ask you about the echo group and how to access them? Maybe we can add this to the slides when we pub or when we put it on our website. Also es geht um diese Echo-Gruppe, wenn man komplizierte Probleme im Verhalten hat, dann kann man sich an diese Echo-Gruppe wenden. Und Inge meinte, dass man das nochmal in den Folien dann mit reinkopieren, sodass sie dann wissen, wie man diese Echo-Gruppe kontaktieren kann.
Problem is that parents cannot contact the Echo group, but your physician can contact the Echo group. And then there's, you can fill in a form and then the doctor presents the clinical problems at a meeting of the echo groups, usually a Monday evening late, from all over the world. And then there's an advice. We discuss the issues together, and then there's an advice to the physician. So parents cannot directly contact the echo.
Und es muss auf Englisch sein. It has to be in English. Yeah.
Also.
Ja, wir haben uns entschieden, ich habe vorher mit Ingrid mal Margret Wallinger gesprochen, dass wir erst Margrets Vortrag hören und danach haben wir dann Chance, an beide nochmal Fragen zu richten. Und ich möchte nur kurz erwähnen, wir haben heute, hat uns sehr gefreut, die Dr. Natascha Mikuski und die